companions. We help you discover your many layers. You feel your car, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Do you want to meet other dreamers, thinkers, change makers, and disruptors? Join us at the Reconnection Playground Community Hub. Meet interesting people to experience interesting things, find partners for your projects, and more. Link in show notes. Do check us out.
So my name is Jolene. I'm the founder and CEO of UrbanTella Singapore. It's been a good 9 months since I started the business. I started it in August 2020. We are a fully integrated farm-to-table ag-tech business or agri-business. I would love to tell you guys more about that. And I think the reason why I started this was really to find a new way for consumers and farmers to interact and create a new kind of e-commerce experience as well, based fully on freshness and hoping to achieve certain sustainability and impact goals as well.
Tell me a little bit more about your journey. What drove you? What motivated you to start this and enter this specific field of urban farming and trying to sort of deal with local self-sufficiency and food?
100%. So I think the entire journey has to start with when the world descended into COVID. I had my first job after graduation. I really didn't like what I was doing. And I left my job thinking that I wanted to do something in the space. Previously, I was working in an education company, working on sales and recruitment. And after that, what happened was I, for some reason, ended up becoming a special needs teacher for a while, right? So I didn't really leave that education space. And shortly after, I joined another startup as co-founder called the Maju Collective. And I think that's when I properly turned entrepreneur. In a sense of there being a lot of uncertainty, having a certain vision for things. And what the Madra Collective was doing was really thinking about how young people who wanted to work in social impact and sustainability often very rarely had an angle into it, or that education didn't give them a realistic picture of what jobs in those spaces looked like. And the solution to that for us was unconventional educational experiences where young people could really interact with industry, understand the challenges, the opportunities, and really figuring out how they could find a place in that, develop the skills and critical understanding for that as well. 2020 was the year of food and agriculture. I think it was interesting because it was a time where everyone had their summer plans canceled, and we were like, what could we do to sort of give people an opportunity to think about a new topic, talk to people in the industry as well. So what we did was to run a series of hackathons online around May to July. We ran three of them, all called 30 by 30 in our next generation. And 30 by 30 really was a tagline that came from the Singaporean government and Singapore Food Agency when they were created in April 2019. And 30 by 30, the plan literally refers to producing 30% of Singapore's nutritional needs by the year 2030 in Singapore locally, right? So for context, Singapore imports more than 90% of its food. We grow less than about 10% of it right now. And the goal of getting to 30% by 2030 was this really interesting goal and this really interesting vision. 30% of our nutritional needs has been outlined to focus on leafy greens, eggs, and fish. Right. So this was a really interesting conversation that opened up. And when I was running the hackathon, of course, you know, like organizing it, planning it, coming together, it was really interesting because I think I really entered an industry and spoke to everyone that I could. There was a lot of goodwill for people who were working with me in the capacity of education, people who shared their work, people from VCs, food tech scientists, farmers, a lot of farmers, people who are innovating in the space, startups, big corporate MNCs who are working in agriculture. And I think that really gave me a different perspective and a lot of insight onto what was happening in Singapore, where sort of COVID accelerated that conversation on food and agriculture and ag tech as an industry. Around that time, you know, the hackathons went really well. We attracted more than 60 people to participate. We had a wait list, more than 40 industry partners who I still am in touch with now. And the outcomes of it were really exciting because I think we discovered a new way of running a hackathon in that sense. We didn't want a solution. We didn't want to hear a pitch. What we wanted was for people to understand an ecosystem and an industry that frankly, no one in Singapore is familiar with, because we don't have an agricultural pathway, right? We don't have an educational pathway to that career. We don't have too much exposure to it. We've been disconnected, disenfranchised from a heritage of growing food in Singapore, I think, for the past two generations. So in that period, I think what happened was we wanted to focus on critical thinking and systems thinking about who are the critical stakeholders in that system. How do we map out the people who are part of our food supply chain, that value chain? Who were the players involved in making decisions? Who was, you know, moving and shaking things in the industry? And what could we look forward to as well? And what the talent problem and talent opportunity was for young people living here and being here without necessarily having an agricultural background. A lot of the topics that came up involved, you know, the cost of food production here, technology involved in speeding up food, what is our relationship with food when so much technology comes into play, how do we educate consumers, how do we as consumers have those conversations with our parents, right, have those conversations with our communities, talked a lot about price parity in food, there's this new wave of alternative protein, this new wave of other ways of producing food and what's good for us, what's too expensive, and how we as consumers and young people could interact with that conversation as well. So in that period, I think a big topic that came up in the context of Singapore and Asia really was that we were sitting on a food crisis, right? Asia at least would have billions of people to feed by the year 2030. And due to the farming practices and what's been going on for a few decades now, we have problems of degraded farmland, climate change, erratic weather, resource scarcity, and how do we feed people in Asia, this region, right? So I think what that led me to was also this better understanding of fresh produce and the space in which how unique it was to be working with fresh produce as a commodity, unlike any other sort of non-perishable good that people needed. Fresh produce is somewhat supposed to be recession-proof, but in you know, a pandemic era, in a time where there is great social inequality, what does that look like? How do we feed the world sustainably as well? And from that conversation, you know, I met my current business partner, and he and I now run a venture studio, and it's been great fun being part of it. We build circular economy startups in food, feed, and agri-tech. And Urban Tiller is one of the portfolio companies that I founded last year. So in our conversation, sort of, we really started talking about how do we value add to customers so that they would want to educate themselves about fresh produce and food security and sustainability in food production. How could we approach that conversation? How do we value add to the people producing our food, right? And I think that's where Urban Tiller really was born. So what Urban Tiller does, let me just take a few steps back. In terms of trying to reimagine this food distribution and food supply chain, is one, how do we sort of reduce water use, right, in agriculture compared to conventional agriculture? The farms that we work with, we strive to achieve up to 90% of water use that is reduced. And we focus on controlled environment agriculture, which then allows for cleaner food, safer food. Most of my produce is pesticide-free. I would say that a lot of people have those questions, right? They'll be like, oh, is it organic? What is organic? What's really good for you? And I think those conversations get started when you start a business like that. The second one is really food waste. A lot of the food that comes in our supply chain, which is in Singapore more than 90%, the stats are that about 40 to 70% of our food is wasted along the supply chain even before it reaches our tables. That happens due to mishandling along the supply chain, damage, or the lack of proper climate control for fresh produce. So that's a lot of food wastage that happens. I think in the year 2019 alone, we wasted more than a billion tons of food purely on just moving it around, right? That's huge. And the next one was really nutritional security, right? There's food security, which is already language that is heavily militarized. It's slightly political as well when you think about securitization. And I think when it comes to nutrition, what Urban Tiller hopes to do is that we know that leafy greens and fresh produce are a category of food that has nutritional content that degrades over time. In fact, we know that up to, you know, some categories of leafy greens that are part of our staples, like baby spinach or even any kind of spinach, they could lose up to 90% of their nutrients, including things like vitamin K, within the first 24 hours of harvest. So we really wanted to build a business model that could accommodate so many of these things, but still be something innovative and something that we could iterate and learn from. And that's how we arrived at trying to deliver fresh produce within 8 hours of harvest, right? So it became a whole supply chain company, it became an e-commerce experience company. And I think the team is very, very ambitious in terms of what we want to achieve as well. So that being said, the last 9 months have been a start, right? It's been a start. It's been a good way of starting to see how we can validate some of these assumptions, whether or not there is a segment of community that we can start with to see how far this can go. And I think the goal is really to reimagine how we distribute fresh food and feed cities across Asia and support farmers in that sense as well. Yeah, maybe I'll take a pause here. I know it's been a lot of content. Yeah.
Maybe just to sort of clarify this for listeners who are not that familiar with Urban Tiller. So what Urban Tiller does is sort of like a middleman that delivers the fresh produce from farms in Singapore to households.
Absolutely. So it's a two-touch supply chain. And it's interesting that you call me a middleman because I think the intention for us was to remove all other middlemen, right? The truth is food that we see on the supermarket or that we buy in a retail store is expensive, right? Because it's passed through the hands of first the farmer, then a distributor, then a wholesaler, then someone who distributes it to retailers. And every middle person takes a cut, right? Every middle person is trying to move it, they lose some of it. And we're trying to eliminate that. So at Urban Tiller, we run what we call a two-touch supply chain. We pick it up from the farmers in the morning, we fulfill your order, and then send it off to you. And that really reduces the amount of waste that happens because we reduce the time spent, the food is spending on the supply chain, and we're able to quality assure the quality of the produce because it's so fresh, and also our relationships that we have with the farms.
Which means that all of your customer base come from your platform and your network.
Absolutely.
And for the farms themselves, do they also sell to other sort of outlets or shops, or is it just through Urban Tiller?
It depends on the farm. There are farms of different sizes, farms of different capacities, and farms that have been around for longer than others, right? So farms who have a much larger capacity and have been doing this for a long time, they might be supplying to other players, be it supermarkets, be it retailers, be it direct consumer as well. So that's definitely the full spectrum of farms that we want to work with. And I think it's a big focus on smallholder farmers, right? Because if you think about the decentralization of food production, if you think about smallholder farmers who are coming up with more sustainable ways of growing food, they might not always be mega farms. And in a very, very densely populated city like Singapore, you have land scarcity, right? Land for all of the huge farms to come up. And I think with smallholder farmers, the difficulty for them is really how do they get access to market, right? Because without consistent supply in large quantities, you can't quite supply to players like supermarkets, right? You might be producing food at a higher cost in the middle of a city, so you might not be supplying to things like wet markets or community markets where the prices are a lot lower. So there needs to be a new business model, I think, when it comes to new age farming, urban farming, high-tech farming, and that really comes down to how much value can you preserve for the consumer. And what I mean by that is really that what's the difference between something coming out of a high-tech urban farm, well-controlled, high-quality, clean, traceable and safe, when it goes on a supermarket shelf compared to something coming in from neighboring countries from a mega farm, right? Like China, Thailand, Malaysia, whatever it might be. What you see on the supermarket shelf is undifferentiated, right? Why would you pay more for something just because it's local? I think price sensitivity is still very, very intense when it comes to consumers buying something as low value and as staple as leafy greens. So I think for us, there really needed to be a revolution in terms of thinking about the value that we are bringing to consumers. And that for us really lies in the freshness and also the assortment that we get with the sustainability story as well.
I want to take you a couple of steps back because I'm curious about your education background and what is it about that that maybe came up with these thoughts and ideas and how you are processing a lot of these things, which are also in there, I hear complex systems thinking and connecting all the different dots. And even though you're talking about farming and delivering and producing these sort of platforms that allows for more consumers to take on local produce, there is a lot more to it from what I'm hearing, which is about education, which is about awareness, which is about capacity building. So how did everything come together?
That's a really big question. I think my background is already quite a bit of a haphazard jumble. I'll begin with the fact that food is something that's very personal to everybody, right? We have emotional connections to food. We have a financial connection to food, how much we spend on food, how we grew up, how our families spend on food, what we grew up eating, what we understood, what we don't understand. I think for me, there was always an aspect of growing up in Singapore that I, would always remember, because in Singapore, you pretty much grow up going to a farm for the purposes of a school trip, right? It was an exhibition. It was an excursion. It was not part of your daily life. You were reminded of the fact that someone's growing your food, but you don't actively think about it. You don't actively think about the difficulties, the challenges, the work that goes into it. When I moved abroad to study, it was a very, very different story. I left Singapore when I was 16, and I finished my last 2 years of high school on a scholarship in Europe, right? And I was living in Italy. I was living in a wine producing region. I was living close to farms, and I spent time on farms, and I spent time with people who were making food in Italy, where food culture was so big, right? There was a lot of national pride when it came to their own food, their own national cuisine, and chefs there spoke very differently, right? Every restaurant likes to talk about where their ingredients come from. They like to talk about the quality assured by the farmers themselves. These are not conversations we ever had in Singapore, never, right? Maybe if you went to a fancy restaurant, they'll tell you that this product is super good because it was flown in from so far away, and it's worth that much because it's so exotic. When I was living in Europe and in Italy, there was nothing exotic about good food. It was a very, very common occurrence, and the best food that we had, in fact, was grown very, very close by. And I think I missed a lot of it when I came back to Singapore. And I understood that there was a very, very different model of what jobs and what careers looked like in Singapore. All my friends here were thinking about getting jobs that paid well, that were comfortable, that were secure. While I think I had been away, and I thought a lot about alternative ways of interacting with the world and interacting with things that were so essential and emotional to us. So when the opportunity came up to think about something like that, I think a lot of that came back, but also my own understanding of tech and my own understanding of how people functioned when so much of our consumption happens in a one-directional way, right? We're presented with options and we make choices. We don't really get connected to how these options even came to be presented to us the way they are. Growing up in Singapore and living in Singapore, like, it's convenient, right? You go to a supermarket, there's a mall everywhere, there's a convenience store, everything is always abundant. But you don't really ask questions about where those supply chains are coming from. You don't ask about how much it actually costs and the true cost of growing food. So, and I think at the same time, COVID brought up a lot of questions, right? It's whose responsibility is it? And I like to use this analogy because fresh produce, in which I work with now, requires a lot of attention and care, right? Unlike a Lazada, Amazon e-commerce economy, where you basically order anything you like and it's in your house in 3-4 days, right? International shipping, you know, parcels are thrown around. That kind of convenience happens on a very different level with produce. You can't just throw fresh food and ship it without care, right? It starts to rot, it starts to damage, and that's food that could have fed someone. And in COVID, we think about, okay, so who's responsible for vaccines in rural areas, right? Vaccines require a cold chain, so do fresh produce, right? In fact, a box of tomatoes grown in Nigeria could be more expensive, but rotting on the road and no one buys those tomatoes as compared to tomatoes coming in from China and shipped in on cold chain, right? Those things are a lot cheaper, and it's going to be a lot more challenging to find cold chain support for a farmer in Nigeria to supply to their own people. Whose responsibility is it? Who pays for that, right? Is it the private sector? Is it the public sector? Is it the government? Is it a nonprofit international organization? I think those questions we haven't quite answered together as a society. And when it comes to something as fundamental as food, and it seems like there needs to be, you know, innovation from the inside, and there needs to be a sustainable and economically viable way to do this. And I think that's how it all comes together, right? Because there's an understanding of the stakeholders who are having certain challenges, certain difficulties, and you realize that it's a matter of who cares about this, who cares, and whose jobs would pay them enough to care, right? So I think that was the main preoccupation. I hope that, does that give you an idea? Does that kind of answer the question? How else can I supplement this?
Yeah, it does, but also in my mind, I'm just thinking, I think because since coming back to Singapore, one question that I ask myself quite often is, who cares in society? Who cares in this society? What makes people care in this society? Because sometimes it can feel like people seem comfortable enough to be indifferent. So then throwing that question back at you, you know, what was it that made you care?
No, that's a fantastic question, right? I think for me, there was a moment in my first job where I was really, really annoyed, right? Corporations run the world and at, you know, at risk of sounding a little bit naive and a little bit idealistic. It's all these numbers, right? It's all these numbers, and it's about like, how do we keep something profitable? How do we like keep the sales number up? How do we make the most number of sales? How do we hit commission? Every person in the system has certain incentives and certain rewards. I was very curious about intangible incentives. I was very curious about the relationships that could be built in really trying to understand a system and a value chain in which people worked in, and how incentives and rewards could be very, very non-tangible. And this sounds very, very silly because I need to survive. We have bills to pay. But I think the beginning of all of this was when I started talking to the farmers here, even before Urban Tiller existed, you know, going down to their farms, seeing the places that they worked in, seeing how food was being grown. One thing that never changed was how generous they were. And you don't forget how someone makes you feel when this is something that they've spent months growing. And they're just so generous. Like, they just want to let you taste it. They want to let you experience something different. And you always remember it. And I think that was when I was like, I want as many people to taste this as possible, because when you have that experience, something more fundamental changes. It sounds a bit hippie. It sounds a bit crazy. But I do think that, you know, there is something very, very fundamental about enchantment. Most of us are very, very disenchanted in the world that we live in and the work that we do. And I think when it comes back to food, there is a very, very fundamental sense of wonder, of a way, like amazement, of being blown away. And that's what happens when you taste good food. That's what happens when you taste really, really fresh food, more than just a piece of steak. Before I started this business, I did not care about what was in my salad. I was not a snob for lettuce or kale, right? That's definitely not something that happened. But because I've managed to meet farmers who do these amazing things, which give you like magical experiences, that's when I realized that, okay, the challenges that they face are not just theirs, right? It affects all of us. Because if we want to have those experiences and want to taste food that is that good, something needs to change about the system. Something needs to be done to keep it more sustainable. And we need to give them the opportunity to try that, right? But okay, eventually it became a business problem again. I was like, yes, I want this to continue going. I want as many people to be able to taste good food and good produce from these amazing people. I need to keep this sustainable. I need to make it viable for them to continue doing what they're doing. And then the business question comes up, right? But I think that fundamental sense of enchantment and wonder keeps me going even today. Yeah.
Sounds like passion is very much a mix of care, emotional connection, and curiosity, which it's really Absolutely. Brilliant to hear all that energy from you. I guess my next question then comes, you know, the entrepreneurship startup journey must have been difficult. What were some of the struggles that you faced along the way? What were some of the, you know, the different pain points, the really difficult muddy bits that you had to navigate and climb out of?
Yeah. So I'm not going to lie, right? I didn't grow up in a family that was comfortable, super comfortable in that sense. And when I decided to leave my job, it was already like a big mental step. I'm just going to get the elephant out of the room, right? Like in this time and day, we think about a paycheck. We think about the money that's involved in a job. You want that security so that you can do everything else. I think when you take up entrepreneurship and you decide to move into that, you sacrifice having a stable paycheck for being able to do what you want for your job, right? And you get to choose the people you want to work with, you choose what you work for. But it was uncomfortable. It was very uncomfortable. As a fresh graduate, I think stepping into this 1 year after graduation, I was still grappling with the idea of where is security going to come from, right? It was like, not just how do I feed myself, but like, do I know how to do any of this stuff? Like, I don't come from a finance background. I'm not a business major. How do I do fundraising? How do I manage the cash flow and the accounts of a business? All of that came along the way. It came along the way, but there was a lot of daily sort of keeping the faith, right? And going like, let's just give this one really good shot. And maybe a few good shots, right? And pick myself up a few times. And sort of like think about how if the work was fulfilling and gave something back to me that was valuable to me and fulfilling to me, and I need that in my life right now, then maybe financial stability and the financial concern is less important, right? At the worst, I'm starting a food business. I'll just eat the leftover inventory for lunch, right? Which still happens a lot. But I think in that period and the process, I've been able to control my own time. And in return for that freedom in time and the ability to build a business from scratch, I've met wonderful people along the way, like taking the time out instead of having to fill out a report and be accountable with like to someone else. I'm still accountable to a lot of people, but I think I've been able to squeeze out time to build really nice, like really nice and strong relationships with people who care about similar things. And that truly, I think, is the most rewarding thing in itself. I cannot imagine going back to a job where I don't know my colleagues, where I don't fully understand their motivations, where I don't fully feel like I could connect with them about what we're doing. And I think that's the most magical part of it. Next is, I mean, being a young founder and being a young head of a company is always challenging, right? Especially in a very logistics and operationally intensive business. Almost everyone I work with and everyone I hire is older than me. And, you know, that changes the entire perspective of what you think you know, what you think you can do. And then you have egos, right? Egos come in. People who are older than you start to try to tell you what to do, start to try to tell you that this is based on experience, not going to work. And then sort of expect you to prove them wrong, but also don't really give you the chance to do that. And I think all of these things, you know, come to everyone who starts a company and starts hiring their own employees. And I think it's something that has always been a challenge, but will remain a challenge. And the lesson from that I've taken away is to remain very, very humble and to remain kind, but also to remember why you started and have daily reminders and the ability to reflect on what you think you know, what you think you don't know, and what you don't know, you don't know. So no one has all the answers, right? No one has all the answers. And I think when it comes down to entrepreneurship, if someone thinks that they have all the answers, but they haven't built the same thing yet, then okay, then it's fine, right? At least you're trying. So that's that. But I think I have had wonderful people work with me, and I've been very, very lucky in terms of all the difficulties that I've had in terms of working with people only came from, just with limitations and restrictions, which are always there. Building a COVID business is not easy because everyone's life is sort of in midair, right? So I think I've hired a lot of employees who had their own plans upended by COVID. And the ability to convince someone to believe in your dream more than their own sometimes, right? When their life is on hold. I think that's a very, very difficult thing to do, but also something that you have to take responsibility of. All of a sudden, you know, as a founder, you may not be the most financially secure, but I personally feel like when I do hire someone, when I do take someone on, there's great responsibility in making sure that their livelihoods are safe, and making sure that they're getting paid fairly for their work, they're doing things that will take them somewhere else as well. Understanding that being an entrepreneur is lonely. Whoever you hire might not stay with you forever, but you still have to be the best person that you are. And that's been an extremely, extremely humbling journey. It's been an extremely good journey as well. Very tiring, but I think, you know, in all of it, you choose to do this as well, right? So there's that. And fundamentally, I think the industry that I've chosen to be in is not easy, right? It's unlike modern tech businesses where you know, with a tech business, like a fintech startup, right? Sorry to pick on fintech, but like, you know, you figure out whether a product works very, very quickly. In 3 months, you know what you need to fix. In 3 months, you know whether or not you're going to be a unicorn. Maybe not 3 months, but you figure that out quite easily. When you're in agribusiness and you are connected to food production and you're connected to demand and supply of a market with a product that everybody eats, product market fit doesn't come so easy. You don't know if you're doing the right thing. You don't know if you're on the right track. You don't know if the numbers you're getting is an indication of a good thing or a bad thing. Like that runway of knowing how you're doing comes not after 3 months, but comes after years and years of it. And every single day you have to commit yourself to that quality, right? So I think it's become a very, it's become a practice. It's really become a practice, right? And focusing on the fact that this is the long game. And I entered fully knowing that, right? That I have a good number of years ahead of me and I'm willing to dedicate a lot of it to this because nothing easy is worth doing. And I think here you have so many people connected in this supply chain and value chain of food as well. So for example, the farmers that I work with, they know that they're in for the long haul. Am I ready to be in with them for the long haul? And the answer came up to be yes, right? So at the start, I was working with one or two farms, and now I'm talking and getting supplies from about 12 to 15 farms, understanding how their operations run, trying to grow with them, trying to give them more business, trying to make sure that offtakes and demand and supply are all being talked about, and we're able to improve the systems and processes and how we work. And that takes a lot of time. That takes a lot of relationship building. And when it comes to scaling a business, how do you share those relationships with others? How do you train other people up to speak to people? How do you align what people care about? I think that's the fundamental question in entrepreneurship, right? I admire everyone who's been in this longer than I have, because entrepreneurship is a crazy, crazy journey where you're literally trying to convince other people of your dream, right? Like employees, associates, investors, advisors, and all of these people. When at the end of the day, you have to come back to yourself and look at everything you have to do and go like, yes, this is going to work, right? And you have to sort of cycle yourself into that. So that's definitely something, you know, shout out to everyone out there who's been doing this and has tried. I think failing in this is never a shameful thing. I think a failed entrepreneur is always one of the most valuable assets you could hire or just be with or hang out with, just because I think, there's so much that you've learned the hard way. You know?
There must have been moments when it's really scary or super exhausting. How did you manage to deal with all that? Like sometimes it's also a very lonely journey.
It is, right? And sort of for me, there is, you know, the side of the farmers and people I take supply from, and I'm their partner, I'm their customer, I'm their associate, and I'm their ally. But as an e-commerce business, I also have to take care of like quality and customer service and all of these jobs that we in our heads think of could be very, very difficult, right? Like when you push out a product and you think it's the best thing in the world, someone comes back to you and goes like, hey, I really don't like this. Like, or like, today was really bad. It happens, right? Once in a very short while. And maybe they don't understand the product. Maybe something went wrong. And you know, so many things happen on a daily basis. There are fires to fight all the time. And of course, there are moments you look at yourself and you go like, wow, this is tiring. I don't know if I have any more in me. But I think the moments that I have like this have always been overcome by the people I have around me, right? It's the fact that we're gonna do this again tomorrow. We're gonna have a second shot at it. We're gonna talk to the person, we're gonna be it a customer or anyone, and just go like, we're gonna do the best that we can. And we're going to give them the best experience that we can. And we try again, because I think at the end of the day, when you see the people around you satisfied, the people around you fulfilled, when you see the people around you excited about something, I think that's when, again, magic comes back, right? I think it's a constant fluctuation between having complete faith in something and it rewards you versus the times when it just doesn't, right? And it happens. As the saying goes, shit happens, like it always happens. You just have to be ready for it and also remind yourself that, you know, this is not just about you, right? There's a lot at stake. There are a lot of other people who have come on this journey with you, who's put their faith in you, and are ready to, like it or not, and believe it or not, they're willing to stick it through with you. Yeah.
You did mention that you didn't come from a business background. So how did you manage to build the business acumen along the way? Because it can be quite intimidating when you've got to make all the decisions yourself, and it's in part numbers, in part how do you disseminate things, how do you publicize, how do you market something, and it's almost, you know, so many different full-time work in one in one role that you have to take on.
100%. So Urban Tiller, unlike some other startups who fundraised even before building up the business, we didn't do that. We bootstrapped it. My business partner, his company also managed to put in a little bit of initial capital. So I would say that, you know, my business partner has been a huge part in this, in sharing his experiences, but also at the same time, fully trusting me. I think there was a moment he looked at me and he was like, "It's fine that you have no experience. In fact, I prefer that. Like, make all the mistakes that you want and go figure it out on your own." And I was like, "No, but I have no idea how to do this, right? I'll try to figure it out." And he's like, "No, that's great. I think for a new age business, that's exactly what you need. You figure out on the way and you never make the mistakes that you make the first time." So there was always that, right? So my business partner definitely has been around to help with that. And learning along the way, like really having a voracious appetite to pick up on things that other people are doing, that other people have done before, and being very, very humble and asking for advice, right? Even if you have started on something that is newfangled, I think learning from the experiences from others, having very honest conversation and going like, "How did you figure this out? Like, this is a real challenge. Did you have it too?" Fortunately, we live in a time where businesses are online everywhere, right? So with things like marketing, right, you think about your favorite consumer brand. What are they doing? What do they make you excited about? How do they get you to tick? When it comes to business, I mean, there's plenty of information out there. What is in black and white is in black and white. Like, YouTube will tell you half of those things. You can always watch videos on 2x speed and try to process whatever you need to. But I think the rest of the, like, business acumen comes from, I think, just being able to realize that you're not spending your own money, right? And that there's value in the business. For me, it's very tangible. On a day-to-day basis, there is fresh produce. If business is not going well, there's produce left over, right? And I created a business that was supposed to be based on reducing food waste, right? So that's one indicator, number one. Number two, sort of like, what are the basic principles that I hold dear? Is it that I will buy it from the farmers and ensure that they have a livelihood at all costs, right? Making sure that when I do want to ramp up in supply, that process is seamless, that process is something that I can manage. What can I do with it, right? Then you're forced to innovate on the spot as well. You're forced to be able to do different things. How do you run a business where you have certain hypotheses that you're trying to validate as a startup, right? Like whether or not this marketing campaign is working, whether or not this bundle on your menu is working, measuring these things and finding other ways to also ensure that you're not wasting any of it. I think that for me has always been very sensitive. So I keep that going, and also am able to then work with my team to say like, "Hey, does this make sense?" Right? We talk it out together. At the end of the day, when I do have to make the decision and make the call, it always comes with, okay, like you weigh the costs and the benefits and the downsides. And I think in the grand scheme of things, because this industry is so complex and so big and the entire value chain is integrated in this business that we've created, you always go back to the big picture, right? You always go back to the big picture and think about, we're going to do this day in, day out for the next, I don't know how many years. Did today give you a positive learning? Did today give you a way to deal with it in the future? And that's fine. Yeah.
Actually, so Onion's Talk podcast started out of International Network for Socially Engaged Practitioners, which I started back in 2017. And when I started this, me developing a practice in socially engaged arts and realizing that there is so much potential in there for social transformation and to support communities in a way that other methods of interventions like therapy or social work probably wouldn't be able to reach. There was so much in there that had impact, yet a lot of these projects are so minimally funded. and that practitioners who are doing this work just find it so difficult to continue the work that's being done, because what happens in most situations is that you have some funding to do the work, but then it barely even pays the work itself, and you're having to do another full-time job on top of the full-time work that you're doing for the impact work that needs to be done. And there is just so much that is there's so much that has to be figured out. And along the way, I think what COVID made me realize also, I think the entire arts industry in general, is that we cannot continue the old conventional ways of doing things, because that's it. Funding is limited. With COVID and the pandemic, it is even more limited than before. And what we're looking at right now is that, you know, what does this mean for artists moving forward? And I mean, there are many kinds of arts, but I fundamentally believe that socially engaged arts has a place in society, because there is so much more that we are contributing that is beyond just creating pretty things. And, you know, what are the ways in which we can continue this practice that can sustain people and create livelihoods and have the sort of practice that can actually build career paths instead of being dependent on precarious and limited funding that is going to be more and more limited along the way. And this is kind of why season two of Onion's Talk, I've been starting to focus on business acumen and how to create an enterprise, or how to create that sort of financial sustainability. And it's just so comforting to hear everything that you've shared, also because, like, me putting myself in this journey, because I realized that this is key to trying to support my community, which is also actually an entire ecosystem, that it's so difficult. And especially when you don't come from that field, when you don't have the ways of seeing things, which I think is also an advantage and a benefit, because when you come from a business perspective and you only see numbers, a lot of times you don't see a social impact. And yep. And when we come with this motivation and the heart to want to contribute and to want to give and to want to care for the people around in society, or the people that the communities we're working with, then the angle comes from a very different angle. It's not about scaling it to be the next unicorn or whatever. It's about creating a sustainable ecosystem for everyone else. And this is where that care comes, that community comes, and where the impact will be more long-term and sustainable.
100%. And I think it's always finding ways of talking to people. You know, like in startup speak, a lot of investors go like, oh, who are you talking to? Which market are you talking to, right? Like, who are you targeting? Who's your segment? These are all valid questions. They're very important. But I think it also, you know, for me, like my practice in my previous startup was storytelling. It was, how do you use story to weave experiences together that are valuable? So it's not just knowledge sharing and education, it's knowledge creation. And knowledge creation that is not one directional, it's how do we start a conversation, right? I distinctly remember one of the first things that we did in a program with students when it came to food and agriculture was we got them a plate of nasi lemak, or, you know, from home, they're like, pick an ingredient in your kitchen and tell me the story of that ingredient, right? And someone picked Nutella, right? This was a six-year-old kid. And she was like, oh, okay, so there's cocoa in Nutella and there are hazelnuts and there's sugar. And she decided to focus on the cocoa bean. And, you know, you think about all the other skills that come in from just telling the story of a cocoa bean. Oh, first the farmer farms it, then it goes here, then it goes here, then it's processed, then it's retail, and then all of this. And the final question that the kid asked us was, I want to understand whether the cocoa farmer has ever tasted Nutella, right? And that question gives you a whole understanding of, can he afford it? Why can't he afford it? Who's making this happen, right? Like, why is it that Nutella is so much more expensive than the farmer who produced it? Why can't he afford this, that? And that conversation is what begins an exploration, that begins curiosity. When people, I mean, humans are curious animals, right? We have to know, we have to tell stories. And as a storytelling animal, I think that's when people only want to tell stories about things they truly care about, right? And they need to feel that personal connection. In Urban Tilla, for example, I'll give you a fantastic example. When I started this, I was like, I have no idea if people are willing to pay just a little bit more for extremely fresh produce. I've tasted it, I know it's amazing. I wonder if it would react, like people would react the same way when they do try it. And funnily enough, you know, like the biggest lesson I've learned on this journey is that you can't make people pay a little bit more just because it's sustainable, just because it's local, right? You can't make people pay for an idea that they don't quite understand. When I started doing this 3 months in, I started realizing what was happening was people who came back to me as customers again and again, they would leave me a message and they would say in the feedback form, they would be like, this is unlike anything I've tasted before. Can I actually have a conversation with you or go down to the farm and speak to the farmer? Right? And these are people who have like high flying jobs and they're like, I just want to do this on the weekend and like understand who's growing my food. That was sparked purely because I taste the difference, right? They're like, I come back to you because I taste the difference. And that's when you start a conversation. I couldn't go up to someone on the street and just go like, hey, would you pay 50 cents for this? And then like, you could learn about this, right? You can't do that. But when people have an experience, right? It's always experiential. It's always about experiencing the amazement for yourself, right? And they'll be like, I want to be educated. I want to know now. I want to be curious and I'm going to put in effort to do that. And God knows how many people along that supply chain benefit from that, be it the farmer, be it someone who's selling you that product, be it the person who's delivering to you. Everyone is suddenly smiling because the work is not in vain, right? Someone has smiled, someone has given back, someone has projected energy that they enjoyed it, right? And I think that's what fundamentally makes what feels like menial work very satisfying. Right, like I know when I do come down to pack vegetables, I'm like, yeah, okay, this bag is going to go to someone. How would I deal with this if I know that my family is going to be eating it, right? It's always about love. It's always a labor of love. It's always a labor of, especially with food, it's always a labor of going like, hey, what's the story that goes into this, right? Who does it end up with? How does it end up there? So I completely agree with you. Socially engaged art can definitely take a lot of forms. And there's something so fundamental, especially in a time when we're all disconnected and we can't physically be together, we can't physically be with people, we can't go anywhere that we want to explore what we want to, right? Curiosity is sparked in a very different way.
Yeah, I think like one of my biggest struggles entering this sort of business enterprise space is, it's like what you said, you know, everything's divided into categories, your numbers, your statistics, or your market. And coming from a lot of research background and into systems change, systems thinking, and understanding your social issues, they are all interconnected in so many different ways. And that the entire ecosystem exists as a whole and not individual parts. It was really difficult for me. Like I realized there was a language in there that wasn't bridged. What I was saying was too macro and complicated for people in a business space to understand. But in the business space, they were speaking this money language and numbers that I didn't really understand either. And I didn't understand their perspective, which I think like along the way you learn what they're trying to tell you about, that is sort of a response of customers' demands or needs. But I think now when we look at the world and how we're, I mean, the issues that are on our shoulders when it comes to the climate crisis, when it comes to, you know, all of these different inequalities and the insecurity that comes to people's homes that the climate crisis will bring about, what kind of businesses we have to create for the future. It's not just going to be whatever that is just responsive. What is it that we can create that can do more, that can fundamentally benefit positively the ecosystem, not just humans on a certain comfortable side of the planet, but you know, humans as a whole on different parts of the planet, but also the environment, the animals, the entire ecosystem. And I think this is our biggest challenge sort of moving forward and a challenge that our generation will have to seriously start considering more, because this is going to be our future. And if it's not our future, it will definitely affect our children or grandchildren's futures.
100%. And I think somewhere in there in what you're saying is also about picking your battles, right? Like I think everyone has already so much to think about, so much to deal with. Where do you expend that energy and where do you sort of like try to seek the most value and create the most value as well?
I have this question that I ask every person who comes on the podcast. If there is something that someone can do to create change, what would that be?
I think it's the other, I think the one thing that the person can do is to ask the question the other way. It's what kind of change they actually want to see other people make, right? Because then that highlights something that's a bit more important to you. Flip that question around, like what is change that you wish existed, right? Because that would then matter enough to you. And then I think there the conversation begins. I think it's like the question is fundamentally about what I can do, right? What I can then bang on my chest and say I did. So instead of that, just flip it around, right? Just go like, hey, like what did I wish someone else could do for me? And from there, is that something I can do? Is that something I was able to spark and be able to change as well?
I'll end off with a pretty random question. What is your favorite onion dish?
My favorite onion dish. I was making onion jam yesterday. So I would slow cook onions until it turns into this caramelized onion jam. And you add in some fresh herbs or dried herbs, whatever you like. And it becomes amazing with anything on bread and cheese. Yes, I love onion jam.
Is this something you learned from Italy?
No, it's not. It's something I learned from the fact that I do not like raw onions. So I had to cook it to the point where it's sweet and it does not taste like raw onions anymore.
Where can people go to find out more about Urban Tiller or the work that you drew?
Yes, you can find me on LinkedIn, but primarily urbantiller.sg is where you can find out about our story, taste some of the produce, and also learn about sort of the sustainability goals that we have and meet the team, right? So that's where you can go.
Thank you for your time, Joey.
No, thank you so much.
Peel the layers and be the change. Change-making work is tough. Sometimes it feels like all the odds are against you and it's a constant upward battle. Onion's Talk podcast keeps you going when times are tough and crystallizes learning that you can apply on your impact work. My name is Fia and I'm here to support you. If you're not yet on this journey, give Onion's Talk a listen. Be inspired, be touched, be motivated. Follow me on LinkedIn or Instagram at feeyeh_neo for updates, workshops, and future events. Onion's Talk was born out of INSEP, International Network for Socially Engaged Practitioners, and we launched an online community hub for people like you to meet one another. If you want to meet other change makers, dreamers, disruptors, and thinkers, our Reconnection Playground is the space for you. Have meaningful conversations at our conversation restaurant, share interesting experiences at ShareHouse, go for a virtual walk with others at the park, and last but not least, our Seed Meets Soil program matches you up with potential partners to further your impact work. Check out our website for more details, link in description. If you like this episode and would love to support, subscribe, leave a rating, write a review on iTunes, and consider donating. Your gift will allow me to continue supporting changemakers in a more sustainable way. Onion's Talk is on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, and most other podcasting sites. If it's not there, send me an email at heyonionstalk@gmail.com. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. Catch you next episode.